Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Aujourd'hui, les plateformes de formation en réalité virtuelle comme Resil aident les sportifs professionnels et amateurs à s'entraîner pendant qu'ils récupèrent après une blessure. S'entraîner dans le métavers permet aux sportifs blessés de continuer à travailler leur concentration et leur temps de réaction pour pouvoir affiner leurs compétences et reprendre leur sport avec confiance. Meta et le métavers ont déjà un impact.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Monday, the 18th of March. After an overwhelming election victory, the Russian President Vladimir Putin says he will press on with his war in Ukraine.
I want to give special thanks to our soldiers, the people who are providing for the country's existence.
The US says the vote was neither free nor fair. Israel says it will not leave Palestinian civilians trapped in Rafah during its planned military offensive in the city. And
the most difficult thing that made me desperate to escape was the boss forcing me to have sex with him. He threatened me and said if I shouted, he would shoot me.
A special report on the horrific treatment of African domestic servants in Oman. Also in the podcast, Swiss police block a speech by an Austrian far-right politician and
come up and see me.
Singer Steve Harley has died at the age of 73. Despite a quiet show of defiance from some opposition supporters, Vladimir Putin has been re-elected as president of Russia with a record share of the vote, at least according to the Kremlin. It puts him on course to overtake Joseph Stalin's 29 years in power in the Soviet Union. The US, Britain, Germany and others have pointed out that the poll was neither free nor fair. But that didn't stop Mr. Putin giving a triumphant television address.
I would like to thank, first of all, citizens of Russia. We are all one team who have come to the polling stations today and voted. And of course today, in the conditions we live in, I want to give special thanks to our soldiers, the people who are fighting along the contact line and providing for the country's existence.
Mr. Putin said Russia was advancing in Ukraine, but the army needed to be made stronger. With control of the media and his opponents dead or in jail, his election victory was never in doubt. But in such a controlled society, why go to so much trouble to give the illusion of democracy? A question for Vitaly Shevchenko from BBC Monitoring.
It's a ritual of legitimizing Vladimir Putin's continued rule. And with 30% of the votes counted, the authorities are saying that Vladimir Putin received 88% of the vote, which is an incredibly high figure. It's the highest ever percentage that Vladimir Putin received in an election. He started with 52 back in the year 2000. Now he's got 88. And this is the kind of result you get in a dictatorship, really, where political opponents get fined, jailed, or just die, where there's no free speech or free media. A few independent observers and the electoral authorities are controlled by the government. And all this is what we see in Russia.
Yeah, I mean, the US says it's obviously not free or fair, the election. I mean, does it make any difference to Vladimir Putin's rule in Russia?
Well, some people say that he will feel emboldened and more empowered, as if he needs that, because even before this election, he had everything under control. But the fact is, few autocratic leaders like to be called autocrats. They prefer to show to people at home and abroad that, look, my people are voting for me. They want me to stay. And this is one big reason why this quote-unquote election was held.
Now, we're hearing reports that an election commission official was killed in the Russian-controlled town of Berdyansk in occupied Ukraine. What might change now in Ukraine following this election?
I think few things are going to change either in Russia or in occupied parts of Ukraine. Of course, with this election exercise out of the way, it would be easier for Vladimir Putin to take unpopular steps, such as possibly declaring another mobilization of forces to Ukraine or raise taxes. But the truth is, he was in charge before this election was held, and he's going to be in charge tomorrow. In fact, there are preparations already in Moscow for a concert to be held in Red Square, which seems to be a way of giving Vladimir Putin an opportunity to accept his victory.
Vitaly Shevchenko, Russia editor of BBC Monitoring. Well, although the protests in Russia itself were low-key, there was more open defiance from expatriate Russians in Europe and the US. In the Czech capital, Prague, demonstrators burned an effigy of Vladimir Putin. At the Russian embassy in Berlin, a crowd cheered Yulia Navalnaya, widow of the dead opposition leader Alexei Navalny, when she turned up to cast her vote. Several dozen protesters also gathered outside the Russian embassy in Washington, D.C. Our correspondent there, Will Vernon, told me more about the reaction in the U.S.
We've just had, not long ago, a very brief statement from the White House after the initial results, in inverted commas, were released. They said the elections are obviously not free nor fair, given how Mr. Putin has imprisoned political opponents and prevented others from running against him. And that really echoes what many people were telling me down at the Russian embassy here in Washington earlier. Several hundred people had gathered to cast their votes, but also many of them to hold a protest against Vladimir Putin. And in that queue was Lyubov Sobol. She is one of Alexei Navalny's closest aides, worked with him very closely for many years. She called on Western nations not to recognize the result of these so-called elections and not to recognize Vladimir Putin as the legitimate president of Russia.
Well, let's look at the impact of all of this on Ukraine. Vladimir Putin has vowed to press on with his military operation there. There are reports that the Ukrainians are running out of air defense missiles and could be all out of them by the end of the month. Is the US any closer to agreeing that new funding package for Ukraine?
No, it's not. $60 billion of desperately needed funding for Ukraine. It's stuck in Congress. Some Republican lawmakers seem not keen at all to pass that piece of legislation. There's a huge row about this bill here. President Biden has called repeatedly for that aid to be granted. He says history is watching. It was the first thing he talked about during his big State of the Union speech earlier this month. And, you know, Ukraine, Russia, Putin, these are major election issues here. Donald Trump, of course, often speaks very warmly of Vladimir Putin. He is skeptical about helping Ukraine. Joe Biden is a firm backer of Kyiv. He has called Vladimir Putin a killer. He's called him a war criminal. So you've got two candidates for the presidential election here in the United States with two very different approaches to Russia. So I think, you know, in his calendar hanging on the wall in the Kremlin, after today, the next big red circle Mr. Putin's drawn is on the 5th of November, and that's the US presidential election.
Will Vernon in Washington. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has given a defiant response to international criticism of Israel's military operation in Gaza. He vowed to go ahead with the planned offensive in Rafah, where most of the Gazan population has fled to escape fighting elsewhere. However, at a joint news conference with the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, who's visiting Jerusalem, he did say Israel wouldn't leave civilians trapped in Rafah.
I assured Chancellor Scholz that our goal in eliminating the remaining terrorist battalions in Rafah goes hand in hand with enabling the civilian population to leave Rafah. It's not something that we will do while keeping the population locked in place. We'll enable them to leave because our consideration for reducing and minimizing civilian casualties has guided us and will continue to guide us in the future.
For his part, Mr. Scholz called for more aid to be allowed into the Palestinian territory.
I also spoke to the Prime Minister today about the need to provide the people in Gaza with comprehensive humanitarian aid supplies. We cannot stand by and watch Palestinians risk starvation. Much more humanitarian aid is needed continuously, reliably.
The two men also seem to have differing views on a possible hostage deal. with new negotiations due to resume in Qatar. Mr. Scholz called for a longer-lasting ceasefire, but Mr. Netanyahu said Israel wouldn't accept an agreement that left it weak. So what are we to make of the Israeli leader's rhetoric? I spoke to our correspondent in Jerusalem, Mark Lowen.
I think it's pretty classic Netanyahu. This is a leader who is under huge criticism here in Israel from some members of his own cabinet and, of course, from his Western allies who are growing increasingly exasperated, who are running out of patience with him. We have the US Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer basically calling for his replacement a couple of days ago and being backed by Joe Biden in that call. And he has dug in, which is very typical of him, saying that they have short memories of the 7th of October attacks and that they have, in his words, lost their moral conscience. He is very defiant over Israel's plans to enter Rafah, where about an estimated 1.4 million people are sheltering, more than half the population of Gaza. And he is determined to push on with what he calls total victory. The other interpretation of his words is that he's trying to up the pressure on Hamas ahead of these new ceasefire talks in Doha, to which Israel will send a delegation.
On Rafah, Mr. Netanyahu did say we won't attack while keeping the population locked in place. Any idea of how Israel might go about moving the, 1.5 million Palestinians who are currently stuck there?
Well, they've talked in vague terms about this idea of humanitarian islands, the idea that they would move the population of Rafah to other parts of Gaza, but that would require Israel to find places of safety amidst the wasteland of Gaza, and also places where the civilians of Rafah could find food, shelter, water. And so that will require a lot of time and a lot of military manpower.
According to a Palestinian official quoted by Reuters, mediators at those peace talks are positive about Hamas's latest proposal. How is Israel likely to receive this idea?
I think that they will not accept any idea of a permanent ceasefire while Hamas is in place. They've made that clear, the Israelis, and they would, I think, only accept sort of later talks about the further conduct of the war after Israeli hostages are released. Now, what we understand from the plan so far is that about 40 or 42 or something Israeli hostages would be released in return for hundreds of Palestinian prisoners, the identity of whom has not been disclosed. But it seems like Hamas certainly are pushing for the release of some Palestinian prisoners who actually face very serious charges, including murder and assassination attempts and the like. So it'll be a bone of contention. But we've been here time and time again where the two sides meet and there just is too much distance, basically, between the negotiating sides for a deal to be reached. So I think that nobody's holding their breath.
Mark Lowen in Jerusalem. Well, as we've been hearing, the families of the 130 or so remaining Israeli hostages from the October the 7th attacks by Hamas are continuing to put pressure on Mr. Netanyahu's government to secure their release from Gaza before it's too late. Hopes had been raised of an agreement before the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan, which is now underway, but there was no breakthrough. Our senior international correspondent, Ola Guerin, reports now from Israel on the agonising wait for the families of the captives.
A grim tally in Hebrew. Families of the hostages count the days their loved ones have been gone. They stand outside the Defense Ministry in Tel Aviv, blocking the traffic, reminding Israel of their loss. It's been more than 5 months now. Every day, a torment.
Every morning when I wake up, I make a concerted effort and say to myself, now pretend to be human, so that I can get up and try to save Hirsch, my son, and the other remaining 133 hostages. What I want to do is lay in a ball on the floor, weeping, but that won't help them.
That's Rachel Goldberg-Polin, now a full-time campaigner. She says the clock stopped for her on the morning of October 7th.
As soon as I turned my phone on, two consecutive messages came in that had arrived at 8:11 from Hirsch. The first of the messages said, I love you. And the second one immediately after said, I'm sorry.
Hirsch was caught up in the chaos and terror when Hamas attacked a music festival. He sought refuge in a bomb shelter, but Hamas threw in grenades. There's a glimpse of Hirsch in a Hamas video, his left arm blown off.
Do you believe you will get him back? I really do. Hope is mandatory, and I have to believe it, that he will come back to us.
My name is Nama Weinberg. I'm the cousin of Itai Svirsky, kidnapped from Kibbutz Be'eri.
Nama, we met you in November, and at that time you were campaigning for the release of your cousin Itai. Tell me what you have learned about what happened to Itai.
Itai was executed by the terrorists that guard him. We know he shot him a very short time after there was a nearby airstrike. And we really want Itai to be the last one. We don't want any other hostage to go through what he went through.
Hirsch's mother, Rachel, is still waiting. She says the agony must end, and not only in Israel.
There are thousands and thousands of innocent civilians in Gaza who are suffering. There is so much suffering to go around. And I would love for our leaders, all of them, to say, we're going to do what we have to do so that just the normal people can stop suffering. Everybody's going to have to give in. There's no perfect scenario. And we need the suffering to stop.
Rachel Goldberg-Polin, whose son Hirsch is a hostage, ending that report by Orla Guerin. Well, let's look at something rather different now, and it is possible to learn to be happy. That is the conclusion of a new study carried out at Bristol University here in the UK. It has a 10-week Science of Happiness course, and for the first time it's assessed the mental well-being of students 2 years after they took the course. The university found that if students had made a habit out of, among other things, expressing gratitude, exercising, meditating or writing a journal, then they were happier than their contemporaries. Professor Bruce Hood led the study. He's also author of a new book, The Science of Happiness. He spoke to Audrey Brown and explained first what exactly happiness is.
It's trying to see our own positions in relation to everything else and trying to find the things which make us more settled, trying to not be overly competitive, not aspire to unrealistic goals. It's being content. And that will generate those positive emotional feelings as well.
You use the word content, which I quite like. I was going to say smug.
No, not smug. That smug is really demeaning your neighbor or feeling competitive against others. In fact, that's the reason so many of us are unhappy, because we're comparing ourselves unrealistically on social media.
It does sound a little bit strange to have to practice being happy or working at it. It's kind of counterintuitive, almost.
Yeah, well, the trouble is that we have a brain which is optimized for seeking out problems, which is why the news is full of it all the time, because we've evolved to try and protect ourselves and ensure that we live long enough to pass on our genes. And so we readily adapt to situations, and that's why you need to actively practice positive psychology in order to see the benefits of it.
Why were you keen to establish a science of happiness department, as it were?
I've been a bit dismayed by the kind of industry of self-help and self-care. I mean, I call my book actually a self-destruct book rather than self-help, because I think individualism and this obsession of making sure that you're happy and everyone else has to change around you is the wrong message. I think we need to find our connections, our commonalities, and that will generate much more sustained happiness. The reason it doesn't last as long is, and by the way, it's a balance between self-care and others, not entirely giving yourself over to others. But the reason that happiness directed towards others lasts longer, is more sustaining, is that if you're the instigator and the purveyor of your own happiness, you know when it ceases to deliver anything. Whereas if you enrich the lives of others around you, that produces much more sustained, authentic happiness. And also, you're never sure when they really get bored of it. In fact, there's some studies showing if you look at the brain imaging of people who are doing acts of kindness, the same areas which light up when they're doing things for themselves are increased when they're doing things for others. So in effect, by helping others, you're actually making yourself happier.
Professor Bruce Hood talking to Audrey Brown. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
It's a fear that I have to live with every day. Less than 4 kilometers from where I am, there are neighborhoods where most people had to flee.
The Haitians living in terror as gang violence gets ever closer. A BBC investigation has uncovered extensive abuse of African women working in Oman as domestic servants. Dozens of Malawian women who've been lured there by recruiting agents told BBC Africa Eye that they were beaten, raped and treated like prisoners while working in the Gulf country. Azizat Olalua met some of those affected, and a warning that this report contains distressing details from the start.
I feel like I'm in prison.
They threatened to starve me to death.
This is audio from videos which were recorded by domestic workers in Oman.
If I die, no one will know because they will dump my body.
They are all from Malawi, one of the world's poorest countries.
The very first day I arrived, my passport was taken away from me. They know whatever they can do to us, we can never escape.
The shared footage of their cramped, sparse living conditions, often communicating whilst hiding in a toilet in order to speak without being discovered. The women came together in a WhatsApp group after being duped by dishonest recruitment agents into going to Oman. Georgina was promised a lucrative job in Dubai, but instead, she found herself in the Omani capital, Muscat.
I was not allowed to rest. I was waking up at 3 a.m. and going to bed at 1 a.m. The most difficult thing that made me desperate to escape was the boss forcing me to have sex with him. It was so painful because I had no way to say no. He threatened me and said if I shouted, he would shoot me. I got badly injured because it wasn't only him. He would bring friends and they would pay him after.
It's common for households in the Gulf to have live-in maids. In Oman alone, there are an estimated 300,000 domestic workers, most of them from Africa or Asia. Under the kafala sponsorship system, they are legally bound to their employer. Ekaterina runs an NGO which supports migrant workers in the Gulf.
The laws that are in place prohibit a domestic worker to leave the employer. She cannot change jobs and she cannot leave the country no matter how you are treated.
You crazy!
Please help me out. I locked myself in the room.
The Malawian government asked Ekaterina to help negotiate the release of over 50 women. One woman, 23-year-old Ida, died in Oman, and her body was also brought home. The Malawi government says it has paid over $160,000 for these women to return. Ekaterina believes this sets a dangerous precedent.
The majority of these women have been released because money has been paid to the employer, from $1,000 to $2,000 per person just for the release. How can you buy somebody else's freedom?
Oman's Labour Ministry has told the BBC that it only received one complaint from a Malawian domestic worker in the 2 years to 2023. It said it is prohibited for employers to impose any form of forced labour on workers or to keep their private documents without their written consent.
Azizat Olalua reporting. The European Union has been accused of rewarding authoritarianism in Egypt after signing a new $8 billion deal, which will include efforts to try to reduce the flow of migrants heading across the Mediterranean. Egypt, which has a struggling economy, says it deserves support for hosting 9 million displaced foreigners. Human rights groups, though, have criticised the agreement. Our Middle East editor, Sebastian Usher, told me more about why the EU is strengthening ties with the Egyptian government.
I think there's a sense in the EU that Egypt, as you were saying, Egypt's economy hasn't been strong for a very long time. It's been a particularly bad situation over the past few years, that if it were to go deeper into those problems, that another political collapse in Egypt, in a region that is already embroiled in the war between Israel and Hamas, that essentially Gaza being on the border with Egypt, would make things even worse. So this is an attempt to bolster the stability of Egypt through its economy, through a series of grants and loans, up to $8 billion. It does come at a time that Egypt is in a slightly better situation. It's just done a deal with the UAE of the same kind of amount of money, which has helped helped it to deal with some of its real problems. The fact that it's so deeply indebted has been the key issue with the economy. And that's one of the things which has driven Egyptians in recent years to actually go on these migrant routes. That's what is at the heart of it. The EU has also spoken about trying to diversify further from Russia in its energy supplies. So part of this deal is to develop and encourage the reserves that Egypt has so they can go to the EU.
Sebastian Usher, our Middle East regional editor. The US has chartered a plane to help its citizens escape from the widespread gang violence in Haiti. The flight left the northern coastal city of Cap Haitien. The airport in the capital, Port-au-Prince, is closed. From there, Will Grant reports.
After weeks of a security and humanitarian crisis in Haiti, in which many embassies have airlifted out all non-essential staff, the US State Department has now laid on a charter flight between Cap Haitien and Florida for Americans still stuck in the country. Around two dozen US citizens did take the opportunity to leave, including one man who told the BBC he was going to receive medical attention in Miami. The extent of the humanitarian emergency has turned Cap Haitien into the main safe haven in the country for people fleeing the violence in Port-au-Prince. The UN estimates that more than 350,000 people are internally displaced, and that figure is thought to be rising by the day.
Will Grant. The police say many gang members were killed in a weekend operation to clear roadblocks and seize weapons in a district off Port-au-Prince. A second operation has been underway since Saturday to try to regain control of the main port. Jetri Dumont is a journalist and director and co-founder of the Aibo Post news platform in Port-au-Prince. He gave Audrey Brown an update about the situation where he was.
We have been lucky because gangs' activities have not reached our area yet.
Is there a fear that they will reach where you are?
Definitely. It's a fear that I have to live with every day. To tell you the truth, less than 4 kilometers from where I am, there are neighborhoods where most people had to flee.
How are you able to live with that level of uncertainty?
It's very difficult to live with. You have to always stay in touch with family members, with friends, and with colleagues to understand how one can help each other.
When the violence breaks out, are they targeting people in those areas? Is it a turf war? Is it a way of terrorizing people?
The gangs in Haiti lately has had method very similar to terrorist method. And that's why maybe it's time to consider those so-called gangs as terrorist organizations. They bring terror. And terror, how they bring it? It's crime, collective rape. But now you have a coalition of gangs. They have now what seems to be a political agenda. With what happened 2 weeks ago with the prison break, with the 4,000 inmates that are out, the gang seems to be positioning themselves to negotiate a possible amnesty, but they're positioning themselves also to have an impact in any political negotiation happening around the new transition that is being negotiated right now in CARICOM.
Jetri Dumont. Well, the plan to create a transitional presidential council for Haiti is also supported by the UN and the US, as well as CARICOM, the Caribbean regional grouping. But is it the solution to the chaos? A question Julian Marshall put to Ralph Gonsalves, the Prime Minister of the Caribbean nation of St. Vincent and the Grenadines.
Once the politicians and civil society leaders apply their heart to wisdom, we should have such an arrangement in place so that the Council of Ministers can approve this body and then to appoint an interim Prime Minister upon the meeting office of Prime Minister Henri.
One of the potential setbacks is the fact that this transitional council has been rejected by the powerful Haitian gang leader, Jimmy Charizier. He says he'll have nothing to do with it.
The presidential council is not intended to mute all contradictions which exist in Haitian society. It is to provide a framework for governance and for stability and for security and for humanitarian assistance and for prosperity, prepare the way for fresh elections within 12 to 18 months.
But how can that happen when gangs rule most of the capital, Port-au-Prince, and are extending their influence even as we speak?
Well, the sooner the political leaders in Haiti and the interfaith leaders finalize the presidential council, and the sooner they do it, the better. If not, there is potential for a Bonapartist solution, which is not in the interests of the security of the region.
But that's already happening. Haiti is unraveling.
No. I think you're going to extreme, my brother. You are correct that they're the influence and power of gangs. But there are also large numbers of people who want peace, security, good governance, and development for Haiti. You're going to have ongoing battles and struggles, but you have to have a reasonable governance arrangement in place, which is all-inclusive of all the legitimate forces. I wouldn't give up, as you're suggesting. I acknowledge that there's the presence and the power of the gangs. That is why the Haitian leaders have to move swiftly to have this presidential council in place so that other things will be triggered, including the multinational security support service.
The Prime Minister of St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Ralph Gonsalves, talking to Julian Marshall. A far-right Austrian politician has been blocked from giving a speech in Switzerland. Martin Sellner is the leader of Austria's so-called identitarian movement and has advocated the mass deportation of immigrants. He's classed as a right-wing extremist in Germany, where his secret meetings with members of Germany's far-right AfD party last year triggered widespread protests. Imogen Folks reports from Bern.
Martin Sellner was due to speak in the Swiss canton of Aargau on Saturday on his pet topic of remigration, the forced deportation of immigrants. But local police said he had no permission to hold a public meeting and shut it down, escorting Mr. Sellner out of the canton and banning him from returning for 2 months. It's a sign Switzerland, where 25% of the population is not Swiss, is sensitive about maintaining social harmony. But some argue that by so publicly preventing the meeting, to which only around 100 people had turned up, the police gifted Mr. Sellner far more attention than he would otherwise have received.
Imogen Folks in Switzerland. Finally, the English singer-songwriter Steve Harley, who fronted the band Cockney Rebel, has died at the age of 73. His best-known song, Make Me Smile, reached number one in Britain in 1975. He'd been forced to cancel performances last year after being diagnosed with cancer. This report from David Sillitoe.
You've done it all. You've broken every code.
Steve Harley and Cockney Rebel and Make Me Smile. It wasn't just a huge hit. It was one of those songs that never seemed to have gone away.
You spoke the game. No matter what you say.
And right from the beginning, there was a feeling about it.
What a bore.
And they always ask me, did you know at the time that it would be a big hit? Actually, we did think it would be. I knew the managing director of EMI at the time came to Abbey Road where I was mixing it and he said number one.
During his 70s heyday, there was more than a touch of glam theatricality and single-mindedness. Some of that determination grew out of his childhood. Polio had kept him in hospital for years. But during those years, he developed a passion for music. And after a spell as a journalist, he began trying out his songs at folk clubs before finally hitting the big time. The effects of his childhood polio were lifelong. But on stage, in the spotlight, he said it was the one place he could forget it all and simply be Steve Harley, the rock star.
That report by David Sillitoe. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Joe McCartney and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.